If God were a sports fan, he likes a close game, mm-hmm. and he likes a come-from-behind winner. And I think, you know, in my observation, I'm not a huge sports person, but I think there's kind of two kinds of sports fans. There's one kind of fan where you love your team so much that you never get comfortable unless your team is, like, way ahead. Unless it's just a blowout game, then you can finally relax. And there's another kind of sports fan where you actually kind of like it when your team falls behind, because then they can be a comeback victor. And God is totally that kind of sports fan. Yeah. He loves pulling victory out of the jaws of defeat.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future. Well, I am really looking forward to the conversation we're going to have today. Matt Scogan is with us. He is the president of Hope College, and he's had a career before that in both the government sector and in finance. He's married to Sarah. They have three amazing kids. And Matt, we are so privileged to have you at Made to Advance today.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, I've been looking forward to this for a while, and we know each other, and I know a bit of your journey. And it was fun because even though I know some of what you're doing at Hope and all that, I thought I'm gonna watch some old Matt Scogan footage.
All right. So what'd you watch?
I went back and I caught one. Well, I had to catch, and it's not that old. I caught the Malcolm Gladwell podcast, I'm sure we'll come up in our conversation. Okay. So that was super fun here. And then the other thing, I've never watched a State of the College address before, and I watched the one from this fall, and it was masterfully done. I loved it. For anybody out there who's listening.
Was that the Following the Wind speech?
It was.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for taking the time. I thought you were going to say you watched my talk at Engedi a few years ago.
No, I thought about doing that, but I really remember that really clearly. So
it was amazing. That was my first fall in Holland,
now
over 4 years ago, and it ended up, you reached out to me before I had even moved to Holland and said, hey, I think you're supposed to come talk at Engedi. And I felt like, okay, I'm supposed to take this invitation. And so I accepted it when I was still living in New York, and it kind of became my sort of introduction to the community.
Yeah.
It was beautiful. It was just beautiful.
I remember still watching the numbers for the stream. And, you know, we get, I mean, there's a good number of people that are kind of catching our online presence on any given week. But it was funny with that particular message, because I think what was happening is it was getting shared and shared and shared. And it was a great message. I mean, it was so inspirational, and it was so scriptural, but also, hey, this is what it means to walk and live in faith. And I think it just took off. So we watched the metrics
it
on that message.
It kind of went viral. And I the funny thing was, I didn't prepare for it. It was just me telling the story of how God called me back to Hope. And I accepted your invitation, and then realized, geez, I'm really busy. I don't even really have time to prepare something. So I'm like, I'm just going to tell the story.
And
it was great. It was great.
Which is great prep for even us talking today, because honestly, that's kind of what our podcast is all about. It's not so much necessarily coming in and saying, okay, I've got these certain, this PowerPoint slide deck. It really is speaking out of our own journeys, our own stories, and for our listening audience to get a sense for how God has used you as a leader. And as I shared a few moments ago, my heart for this conversation is that somebody's going to hear the journey that you've been on, and there's going to be something they can take away and say, man, that's not just great for Matt. I could apply that in my life, and it calls them to another level. So that's what I'm hoping for.
Let's go all the way back here.
Great, all right. Give us just a little bit of a sense of your background, kind of where you grew up, and I would say the nutshell of just your professional history before Hope.
Yeah. So I grew up in Portage, Michigan, which is just south of Kalamazoo.
Yeah.
Had the extraordinary privilege of coming to Hope College as an undergrad. So went from Portage Northern High School to Hope College.
Second choice.
That's a funny part of the...
I don't often tell
that part of the story.
Yeah.
So I had, for whatever reason, I had my heart set on going to University of Michigan. And I basically spent my entire 4 years of college assuming that's where I was going to go.
4 years of high school.
Four years of high school. Yeah, thanks. And I applied to University of Michigan, and I didn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
And it totally rocked my world. And all of a sudden, the place I had envisioned myself was, they put me on a waiting list. U of M put me on a waiting list. And the way my mind works was kind of like, well, okay, if you don't want me, then I don't want you. So I didn't even wait around to see how the waiting list thing turned out. I immediately moved on to, like, well, I want to go to a place that actually wants me.
Yeah.
So Hope was was kind of the second choice. But in an amazing way, I see now how God had determined that Hope was the right place for me, and just was preventing me from making a mistake. So it was beautiful.
Well, and that's what I loved, learning that detail today that I did not know, and I was appreciative of you sharing it in that address, is for all of us, we have these ideas and these plans on this is where, this is where God's taking me, this is the plan, I know how I'm going to get there. And already you really hadn't even got started in your professional career, and already right. God's saying, you know what, I know, Matt, that you think you've got the plan and you know it, but I've got better things in mind for you, and part of that is going to involve a detour right from the jump. So you end up at Hope.
I end up at Hope. I study political science and economics. It sounds weird to say it now because everybody hates government, but I love government. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing I loved about government was the whole idea of like complex problem solving, mm-hmm. and taking a complicated public policy question like healthcare or education. And to me, it was sort of a fun intellectual puzzle to try to solve something like that. And it's, they're intellectual puzzles that involve people, and I'm an extrovert, so I've always loved the people side of it. So anyway, I study government and economics at Hope, and then go from Hope to Harvard for grad school, and I study public policy at Harvard, which is sort of an applied political science.
Mm-hmm. Kennedy School, great school.
Yeah. And then I get the chance, for the first 8 years or so of my career, I get the chance to work in exactly what I thought I wanted to do, which was government. So I did two different stints in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. One in the White House. It started out as an internship, actually, that I got through Hope, through a professor at Hope, and it turned into a paid position. And then I worked at the Treasury Department from 06 to 08. And in between, I worked for the governor of Massachusetts in Boston.
Okay.
So got to do kind of economic policy stuff in government. And then I made the first big pivot of my career, moving from the public sector to the private sector.
Right.
And I got the chance to work at the New York Stock Exchange. So that brought us to New York. My wife and I think we thought New York was going to be a relatively short chapter and that we'd eventually go back to D.C. We ended up spending 11 years in New York City. Our oldest daughter was born in D.C., but was a year old when we moved to New York. And then our other two kids were both born in Manhattan.
Oh, so really?
We spent,
Did you ever get to ring the bell? I know, not
I
for
did.
Opening. You did.
Multiple
okay.
times. Yeah.
Okay. Was it fun?
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
it seems
a great
like it would
experience.
Be fun.
Yeah.
When a friend of mine was talking about when they were taking their company public.
Yeah.
She talked about having the whole team out there and ringing the bell and what a great experience it was. I didn't realize she was sharing this with me. The bell ringing thing happens like multiple times a day on certain days. Or she was saying it's not like I imagine as a one time, this is all that happens. But she said it can happen.
It happens twice a day.
Oh, twice
so
a day.
They ring the bell at 9:30 to open the market. And then they ring the bell at 4 o'clock to close the market.
Okay.
And there's usually somebody, usually it's a company that's going public that day is who's usually ringing the bells. And sometimes it's celebrities or sports team that won a championship or something like that.
And then you sneaking in there at 9 o'clock after the market. No,
yeah, that's right.
Because you weren't doing it in an official, like for a company.
Well, when somebody rings the bell, there always has to be somebody who works for the NYSE up there. So I would often be the person from the NYSE who was up there ringing the bell.
Okay.
So I got to do it with some cool
that's
people.
So fun. What was the transition like to go from sort of the public sector to private? I mean, was that hard? Was it fun? Was it easy? Was it, oh my goodness, this is so different?
It was all of those things. I think for me, there was a learning curve for sure. I had not studied business. I had not, I'd done all my studies around government and thought I would spend my whole career in government.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a totally different arena for me. I think, the interesting thing, I spent, 8 years in pretty high levels of national politics, and then moved to Wall Street, the high levels of national finance. And both of those arenas, politics is motivated by power. Wall Street's motivated by money. And but those are two things that Jesus talks about a whole lot.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
talks about money a lot. He talks about power a lot.
Yeah.
And I viewed myself as I viewed it, especially when I was in New York, I was like, I'm not going to spend my whole career here. I viewed it as a ministry. I was like, for whatever reason, God wants me right here at this particular moment. And so I'm just going to view this as ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Like God needs points of light and hope in Wall Street as much as he does anywhere
else.
Right. And so It wasn't something I had pursued. It was an opportunity that came to me, and I felt like I was supposed to take it. So I just viewed it as like, okay, God wants me here, so I'll do my best to love people. And the fun thing about it was I viewed it, I was like playing a totally different game. I wasn't trying to climb the corporate ladder. I wasn't trying to run the rat race of New York City finance. I was there, I viewed myself as there for ministry. So it just was like, I'm going to take myself out of the game and just try to love people and try to serve people. And it
Like in interacting with you, did people feel like this guy is not sort of marching on the same beat as everybody else around here?
People used to call me the pastor of Wall Street, which I took as a compliment.
Yeah.
Not everyone meant it as a compliment.
Yeah. Well, pastor of Wall Street is right up there with, what's the Hope nickname again? Sko Daddy. Yeah. Your secret hip hop career.
Yeah,
reminds
me
of Parks and Rec. What's Ron's? Does anybody know Ron's name? He's the saxophone. Oh, Duke Silver. He's got Duke Silver. Yeah, it's like that's your moonlighting.
Exactly. Yeah, there's like the Wolf of Wall Street and the Pastor of Wall Street.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So the journey and this is the probably the longer version of it is available in our Getty archives on YouTube.
Yeah, that's right.
But you're in New York, and you're starting to at least send some wrestlings, but maybe tell us a little bit of how you ended up at Hope College. The jump, I mean, even from government to finance is a jump, but to go from finance and working in a more private sector role to like Hope College president, Matt, that's weird, man. That's a weird
it's
jump.
It's totally weird. It's totally weird. I think, honestly, the only way to make sense of my life is because it's this very circuitous route through government and business and now higher education. The only way to make sense of it is to view it through the lens of me doing my best to follow where I thought God was leading me. Mm-hmm. And for me, it does go back to my days at Hope as a student. And I grew up in a devoutly Christian home. My parents were deep followers of Jesus. But for me, God was a concept. He was a something. Mm-hmm. And when I got to Hope as a student, God became deeply personal.
Wow.
God became a something, a someone, not a something. And what I realized during my days at Hope was that God loved me better than I loved myself and knew me better than I knew myself. And once I realized that, for me, it was like game over. Mm. Like, who am I to have plans for myself if there's a creator who knows me better than I know myself and loves me more than I could possibly love myself? So game over. I'm just going to follow whatever God has for me. And this might sound really weird, but my junior year of Hope, I basically made a deal with God. And the deal I made with God is, whatever door you open for me, I'm going to go through it.
Wow.
And I'm going to work as hard as I possibly can with whatever opportunity you give me until you tell me to go through another door. And that's the only way to make sense of like these very weird pivots in my career. Because like I said, I love government and I would have been very happy to spend my whole life working in public policy jobs because I loved it. This thing came up at the New York Stock Exchange and I prayed about it, felt like I was supposed to do it. You know, there's this, speaking of, you mentioned plans and then like with the U of M thing and then me ending up at Hope, there's this verse in Proverbs, it's Proverbs 16:9. It says, in his heart, a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps.
Yeah.
And it's saying two things. It's saying humans plan and God determines. And for me, if God has it, you know, if God's determining it for me, then like, I'm just going to get out of the way and just go with that.
Yeah.
And so that's the only way to really view my life. And that's exactly what brought me back to Hope. I love the place. I had stayed pretty involved with Hope after graduating. The long version is in Getty archives somewhere from 2019. But the short version of the story is I felt a very strong sense of call from God that I was supposed to do this. And at the end of the day, you know, the way I'll know that I'm really, what I said to God is the way I'll know that I'm really supposed to do this is if I apply for the job and they pick me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, in the end, that's what happened. Because this felt like, for me, this felt like such a big door. Like, I couldn't knock on this door. I couldn't open this door myself. I had never worked in higher education before. I wasn't an academician. I'm very young by standards of a college president.
Probably 20 years the junior of your
average
president.
I'm 44 now. I was 39 when I started the job. The average age of a college president now is, I think, 66. It keeps going up.
Tell you what, Matt, so just stay on the course you're on. And you'll be the average.
sooner or later. In 22 years, I'll be the average. So, yeah, I mean, it just felt like, you know, I could have never knocked on this door or tried to open it myself. And
maybe share. I love when you're on the subway in New York and there are so many different places that God was making it clear to you, hey, I'm prompting you to take a step forward.
Yeah.
Maybe mention that particular example. And I think that when we're discerning, I don't know if this is true for you. For me, some of those big moves, I have felt like, God, I'm going to need it a couple of times here. For a really bold faith step. I would like to think, and I think it's true, that by the grace of God, as He's grown me and as my faith has matured, I need far less than I used to for moving forward. I feel like I'm more tuned into His voice sounds like. Mm-hmm. Than what I used to, and I have more faith. I mean, my faith is stronger. I get a prompt. I go, all right, I trust you. Let's go.
Yeah.
But I would say for some of the big things, part of this isn't always lack of faith. It's I want to make sure, Father, I'm on your page, not my page. And so I want to really make sure I hear from you. So you're on the subway. Yeah. And I think that's when you got your first phone call. Am I recalling that correctly?
I got the subway is when I got the first
email.
That the job was going to be open. And this was back in 2017. And there wasn't cell connectivity in the subway. So it was very, my phone didn't work down there. So the fact that my phone even buzzed to get an email was a strange thing. So I'm on the subway, my phone buzzes, and I see an email that was sent. I was on the board of Hope at the time, and it was sent to the whole board of trustees, and it was saying that the president was going to be taking the current president was going to be taking a different job at a different institution, and was going to be stepping down. And I don't know how to really describe it, but as soon as I read the email, I just felt this lightning bolt to my heart, and it felt like okay, something big is happening here, and that for me was kind of the first big sign. And there's this haunting line Jesus has, my sheep know my voice and they follow me. And I've spent so much of my walk with Jesus asking myself, do I really know the voice? Mm-hmm. And can I really decipher that voice from all the other voices in my head and all the other voices in the world? And I'm getting better. But sometimes God speaks with a loud thunder and sometimes it's a very quiet whisper. And this was a time when God didn't want me to miss it, and He started speaking softly, and then it became so loud and so clear that I couldn't ignore it, and I couldn't run away from it, even if I wanted to.
Yeah. Well, and what's cool about how the journey plays out is, on the one hand, you have this subjective and internal sense of, I sense that God is saying something to me right now, and that's important, and I think that even in some of your subsequent comments I've heard you talk about, sometimes people who maybe have a more, it's probably not the best way to say it, but a very rational kind of, you know, ideas. It's funny, I believe faith is rational, so I don't want to suggest it's not, but like that kind of a subjective experience, they might diminish because it was an experience.
Right.
But that was part of how God spoke. And then He affirms how He speaks in community, and there are other people giving you nudges and speaking in. And I think that's an important part of discernment too, when you have some in the body of Christ that are saying, hey, you ought to think about this, including your own wife. I mean,
wife was a big part of one of the biggest signs I got was when she started to get excited about this, because she's a very private person, and I didn't think would ever be excited about a public role for our family.
Well, that's a great great transition to you step into Hope, and what is it like to become a college president? There's a lot of jobs you can say, oh, this job is somewhat akin to that or whatever. Yeah. I just feel like there's not a lot of analogous roles to college president. What's it like when you step in there?
It's been fun. I mean, I still feel like I'm climbing the learning curve as fast as I can every day. I think sometimes I compare the job to like a school principal. I think probably the better comparison is to compare the job to like being a mayor of a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember back to your eighth grade civics class, if you had such a thing, there's two kinds of city government structures. There's a strong council, weak mayor, and there's a strong mayor, weak council. And I sort of feel like my job is the weak mayor. Like, you know, I've got the title president, but in a college governance structure, authority is very distributed.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me to get anything done as a leader, it requires sort of borrowing authority from lots of different stakeholder groups. So mm-hmm. the faculty have a lot of authority, the students have authority, the donors have authority. There's a board of trustees, obviously, that's, you know, they serve as my boss. The community, we're the largest employer in the town of Holland, so the community cares a whole lot about us. So there's a lot of stakeholders, which is can be a challenge, but it also means that once we're moving with a pretty broad consensus mm-hmm. of stakeholder groups. And so it's I'm learning.
You knew that. I mean, you knew going into Hope that is the nature of that environment. But knowing it and operating in it and leading through it is a different thing. Did it feel like, especially coming out of the public sector, did it feel like, whoa, this is so different than what I'm used to, or not so much?
It feels more like the public sector than the private sector. I mean, I think governance in a college setting is intentionally set up with checks and balances, much like government. In the business world, you sort of just make decisions and move, mm-hmm. and you move pretty quick.
Yeah.
And that is not the way higher ed works.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think actually my years in government prepared me for this better than my years in business.
Yeah, makes sense. What's the think about this with different jobs? What the average week looks like for a college president? Mm-hmm. And so if I was just following you around, now see, we get a little glimpse of when you do different social media things, and you guys do a great job with your social media and just engaging with students and doing fun stuff that, is makes people laugh and you're not afraid to embrace that, which is great. And I'm sure the students are love it so much. But when it comes to an average week, or if you have to stretch it out beyond that, so be it. But what are you doing? I mean, how much is, I'm with students and I'm with faculty and I'm doing emails and I'm just sitting at my desk hammering away, or what's it look like?
One of the things that I love about the job is there sort of is no average week. Every week's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. There is obviously some cyclicality to the way the academic year plays out. So there's some times of the year when I know I'm going to be really busy. The beginning of the academic year is always very busy. And then the end, it all sort of culminates to commencement. And mm-hmm. so the end is always very busy. So there's some things that are predictable in terms of how I spend my time. There's also a lot of things that are, much less predictable. So last week I was out in California with our volleyball team was competing for the NCAA national championship. And, obviously we would have wished for that, but we couldn't have predicted it. So there's some things where you don't necessarily know and have to kind of pivot last minute. I think at a high level, I sort of view my job in three big buckets. One is casting a vision for the college, mm-hmm. So that we're not just running through the motions, but that we're moving in some direction and we have some sense of North Star. Mm-hmm. We know where we're trying to go as we run through the daily operations. Second is almost sort of a CEO job. I mean, we have over 1,000 people that work at Hope College, and just overseeing the operations of a community.
Yeah, right.
As I said, it's almost like a small town. And you think about the breadth of stuff that happens on a college campus. There's classroom, there's sporting events, there's art and theater performances, there's construction projects, there's 3,400 students who live there all the time. So there's just stuff. There's all kinds of stuff that happens. And overseeing the operations of that with excellence is a big part of the job. And then the other part, and this might sound a little trite or funny, but a big part of my job is PR. A big mm-hmm. part of my job is representing the college to the outside world. And I, when you take on a role like this, you sort of become a living, walking billboard for the institution. And so, and I love that part of it. I believe in the place, and I love representing the Hope College community to the outside world.
Do you think there are many college presidents who are introverts? I mean, they can still put on their game face and do what they need to do, but it does feel like, I guess, when you said earlier you're an extrovert, it feels like the role is given to that kind of a personality.
It is.
Leaning.
I mean, I would ask the same question of pastors. I think the role probably self-selects to extroverts or mm-hmm. people who are.
But you're right. There's a lot of introverts that are in ministry too. So
I think you can figure out how to do it as an introvert. But
your house, literally. Here's something that's different. In the old days, pastors would a lot of times live in parsonages that potentially.
Right.
And my grandfather was a pastor, and I just actually took to my sons to see where he grew up, which is there's the church. You walk across the parking lot, there's my dad's house.
Amazing.
And I just look at that and think, thank you, Lord, that's not what I do.
We could build a house out here in the parking lot.
That's, you know, I've always dreamt of that. I thought it would just be such a great view, all of the parking lot,
yeah, right,
the Chicago Drive right next to us. So easy access to everything, I suppose. That's the upside. So fortunately for me, Parsonage days are over. I don't mind having a little bit of distance, but just to be clear, I love seeing people all around Holland. I think, and Hope for that matter. I mean, to me, that's part of the joy of ministry, but I think living on campus might be a bit of a stretch for me. You have a house that is literally boom right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's
it. We love it. And
meanwhile, Sarah is not like a big extrovert, but it's fun.
Yeah, we love it. I mean, I think it's obviously not a normal neighborhood. We're not raising our kids in a normal neighborhood, but it's amazing. We have two residence halls on both sides of the house and then another one just across the street. So we're surrounded by college students.
Yeah.
And they bring life and energy and passion and activity 24/7. And in an interesting way, you know, we lived in Manhattan for 11 years. And people always say, how do you feel about all the noise from college students? Well, and when you're living in Manhattan, like you go outside of your apartment, it doesn't matter what day it is or what time of day it is. There's just stuff. There's always something going on. So in an interesting way, you know, it kind of being surrounded by all kinds of stuff doesn't, mm-hmm. you know, it actually feels probably more normal than it would if we had lived, you know, moved to like a suburban neighborhood. That probably would have felt more foreign to us.
Do you end up with your family having to do anything with just, hey, we try to get away in these special intentional ways just because we're so, not that you don't love it, but you're so in the Hope scene that you say, oh, let's pull back.
We do. And we have a cottage in South Haven that we escape to if we just need some time for just family, so we do kind of have that as our escape place. But you know, we love living on. The weirdest part about living on campus, I have to say, is when the students aren't around, like during summer break or Christmas break, mm-hmm. because then we're literally living next to empty buildings, and that feels strange. But when people are around, it's amazing. It's fun.
Yeah. I still sometimes, when we go back to Chicago, which is where we lived prior to being in Holland, we had so many people around us, and we lived in a big apartment complex. And it's funny, I still see apartment complexes, and I think, I miss those days.
I mean,
just always seeing people, seeing neighbor. And we live in a neighborhood now where it's very typical, where you're driving into your garage, shut mm-hmm. behind you, and we see our neighbors, but it's not like when you're living in a, you know, all those people around you. So when you think of your leadership role right now, what comes to mind when you think, boy, these are the things I most love. They give me the most energy. And then conversely, what are the things you go, this is the hard part. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the hard part of being a college president.
Well, we talked about some of it. Things by definition move slower, and that can be frustrating. By definition, there's lots of stakeholders, which means there's a lot of people looking over my shoulder mm-hmm. saying, why aren't you doing it this way or whatever. Again, as a people person in general, I don't mind that. So I think if I let it, some of those dynamics could be frustrating, but I don't really mind it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think when I think about challenges, I kind of go to big macro stuff and mm-hmm. higher ed as a sector is under a lot of pressure, and the church as a sector, if we can call the church mm-hmm. a sector, is under a lot of pressure. Well, we're a Christian college, which sort of puts us at the nexus of those two sectors. And there's just a lot of exogenous sort of macro pressure
mm-hmm.
In the space in which we're trying to operate.
Yeah, I know you've commented on this previously, and I don't know if I have my number wrong, or I read an article after you mentioned that since COVID, 21 Christian colleges or universities have closed. I feel like I read an article in Christianity Today that said like 26. It was up to 26. Now I could be wrong on that. It could be it's the 21.
I've been trying to keep my own count.
Crazy.
I think it's 22 now.
Is that right?
So it's about 90 colleges overall have closed since COVID, and 20-something, let's say, of those have been Christian colleges. So that's about 25%. So roughly one out of every four colleges mm-hmm. that have closed since COVID have been a Christian college. When you compare that to, so there's about 4,000 colleges in the United States, a little over 200 of them are Christian colleges. So that's about 5%. So we're the endeavor that we're in, Christian higher education, mm-hmm. is about 5% of the overall pie of U.S. higher ed,
mm-hmm.
but 25% of the colleges that are closing, which just speaks to the reality that there's lots of pressure on higher ed, lots of pressure on the church. So, you know, in some ways you could argue being a Christian college is one of the worst possible businesses you could be in at the moment.
What when you think of the macro level trends that just affect higher ed in general, apart from being a Christian college or not, those are conversations that are in the headlines, so to speak, a lot.
Yep.
What would you identify as some of the biggest pressures that institutions of higher learning are feeling right now?
I think there's two big ones, and the data shows pretty clearly that these are the ones that the public is concerned about. There was a Gallup poll that was done over the summer, and they showed that public confidence in the American higher education system is at an all-time low.
Really?
And not only is it at an all-time low, but it's dropped 20 percentage points in the last 8 years. So 8 years ago, 50% of Americans, one out of every two, had confidence in our system of secondary education. Today, it's 30%, so less than a third. So it's dropped 20 percentage points in 8 years.
Wow.
And you have to read, if you read all the way to the end of the Gallup report, they didn't collect data on this, but the authors speculate on why this drop has been so precipitous. Mm-hmm. And they point to two big things that's causing this major concern around higher education. Number one is the cost. Mm-hmm. And number two, in their words, is that higher ed has become too political.
Interesting.
And I think, you know, look, we're a place called hope.
Yeah.
And I think we view that as part of our calling to, mm-hmm. to go after those things and show the world that there is hope, that there is, that we can be a force for good in terms of renewing hope in higher education. And specifically for us, the kind of education we're doing is Christian education. Yeah.
So with those two challenges in mind, we'll go to the financial side of challenges in a second, but on the political side, one man's opinion is probably not worth a lot, is a good college or university experience, you're going to have a diversity of views present. Sure. You're going to have to wrestle through things. You're going to have people of different perspectives and opinions. It's interesting with a Christian college because on the one hand, you want it to be a place where there's space to wrestle, space to ask big questions, all that. But ultimately, you are trying to help people view their lives and calling out of a Christian worldview perspective. How do you navigate that tension? How does a school navigate those kind of balances?
I've thought a lot about the difference between a church and a college, a Christian college. And so we've got both represented here, mm-hmm. so you can help me think about this. I think a college, by definition, ought to be a community that's maybe more focused on inquiry mm-hmm. and perhaps less focused on the answers to the questions. A church, by definition, you're probably going to be more focused on answers because mm-hmm. You want to have a worship community where you kind of have, you know, shared convictions, shared theological convictions. Whereas I think a college ought to be about inquiry and the pursuit of truth. Mm-hmm. And I would put the emphasis on the word pursuit. I think the beautiful thing about the God we serve, he's clearly not afraid of big questions.
Right.
Read the Psalms. Like they're asking, you know, David's asking big questions. Mm-hmm. How long, O Lord? Why? Read Job. I mean, God is not afraid of big questions. Mm-hmm. If anything, God seems to be more afraid of people who are quick to memorize the answers without really rolling around in the question itself. And the book of Job is fascinating because so Job gets everything stripped away from him, his health, his wealth, his family. And then he starts going to God and he's so ticked off and he's like, God, why has this happened to me? Why has this happened to me? And his friends come to him, and his friends are like, Job, this has probably happened to you because you're a bad guy. You mm-hmm. probably did something wrong to deserve this. Well, the amazing thing about that is that basically his friends, theologically speaking, his friends are right.
Yeah, totally.
Like Job did a lot of bad things, as we all have, to deserve a lot of bad things happening to us. I mean, the big mystery of the gospel is not why do bad things happen to good people, but why does so much good happen to bad people? Mm-hmm. And so Job's friends come to him and they say, oh, it's clear why bad things are happening to you, Job, because you're a bad guy. And theologically, that might be the right, that's the right answer for all of us. We all deserve bad things happening to us. But at the end of the book, God condemns his friends who have, let's say, theologically the right answer. And he says that he's very pleased with Job.
Yeah.
And Job has spent all this time asking big questions and not presuming to have the answers. And I think there's something to that.
Yeah.
I think there's something to that where a college community can really be a place that gives 18 to 22-year-olds mm-hmm. the space to roll around in some big existential questions like, who am I? Why am I here? And what is this whole maddening world all about? And what's my role in it? And I think if we do that well, in many ways, I think our purpose is to help students discover their purpose. Mm-hmm. It's like the great Mark Twain quote, there's two great days in every life, the day you're born and the day you figure out why. And I think part of our purpose is to help students discover that why. Mm-hmm. And I think you're more likely to discover it by really rolling around in big questions rather than just, skipping to the back of the book and memorizing the answer.
Yeah.
In class, there's a name for that. It's called cheating. Mm-hmm. Like going to the back of the book and memorizing the answer is called cheating. And I think the kind of Christianity I grew up with, and I don't know what your experience was like, but the kind of Christianity I grew up with was just memorize the answer. I mean, I memorized Romans 8:28 as a kid. Mm-hmm. All things work together for good. But then all of a sudden, my parents pass away and I go through really hard times. And it's not like I can say, oh, I got this figured out because I memorized Romans 8:28. Right. No, you got to wrestle through it. And it's through the hard times that you realize God is good and He's there in the hard times. But it's not because I memorized Romans 8:28 that I discovered that. It's because I wrestled through the hard times with God.
Yeah, I think Job's friends to me are like the equivalent of the person who sees somebody suffering and just Romans 8:28 them.
That's right.
There you go. It's problem solved.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And even for Job, as much as he was standing on good ground and God commends him, even then, of course, the way it ends is God asking Job a number of questions just to say, hey,
where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?
I think it's a good challenge. I mean, I think part of where churches can struggle, and this is something we're always trying to press into it in Getty, is churches. While I agree with you, there probably is a greater emphasis than on a college on the answer side of the equation. Man, I mean, we've got to have safe places for people to ask questions.
That's
because
right.
if they're not asking questions in their local church and they don't feel safe to do so,
then
the moment they're outside of the confines, if you will, of the local church and they're in that place where they can speak those things out, they're not necessarily going to be in an environment that's as helpful in that regard. I feel like when I think of some of the things I really appreciate about Hope, it's, when I watch folks ask deep questions, I don't have this desire to say, let me give you the right answer, but I do want to help you walk in a wise journey as you're getting there.
Right.
And I think sometimes without an environment that you can have people around you, they're going to help you discern a wise journey.
Yeah.
You end up coming to conclusions and answers that ultimately are not great and ultimately not life-giving, because all of those ideas ultimately affect practically, real things and how we live. And so that's what I think one of the things I love and appreciate about Hope is I feel like, hey, I can be a student who asks questions, wrestles with things, all of that, but I am going to have mentors and professors, teachers, a support structure around me that is going to help me in a wise journey. And that is, that's a huge deal. So I commend you for that. Cause we have students at Hope from Hope all the time here in Getty. And I just, I love seeing them.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's a famous quote I love, which is doubt is the seedbed of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it really speaks to what you said earlier, which is, you can skip to the back and memorize the answer, or you can wrestle through it. And I really believe when you wrestle through it, you come out with a more resolved and strong faith than
that's
you would had you just chapter and verse Romans
8:28.
What more do you need? So
that's right.
Let's go. Okay. So we're talking, first there's the challenge of folks feeling like education is politicized and this kind of thing. And then without a doubt, and probably everybody's familiar with the pretty much nonstop conversation about the exacerbating costs of education.
Yeah.
And obviously this is an area that Hope has done a lot of work. You've spearheaded it with Hope Forward. And so maybe you could just share a little bit for those who have just never heard. I say Hope Forward and they have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Maybe you can tell us what that means.
So I'll start with the premise that, as you said, let's acknowledge there's a problem with the financial model of higher ed. We can go into that more if you care, but let's assume that there's some baseline understanding that something needs to happen to fix the financial model. We took that problem at Hope and we went to our Christian mission.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a verse in Matthew, it's Matthew 10:8, where Jesus says, "Freely you have received, now freely give." And we kind of had this epiphany where we thought, what if we could apply that not just to our personal lives, but to our actual structure, to our actual business model? And that's what we're attempting to do with Hope Forward. So Hope Forward is our vision to reimagine how students can pay for college. We call it Hope Forward because it's basically a pay it forward vision.
Mm-hmm.
It's based entirely on that verse. Freely you have received, now freely give. Now Jesus is talking about the free gift of salvation. There's two things you have to do. First, you have to take some action to receive the gift. Like there's a free gift on offer. You got to accept it. You have to receive it. Once you receive it, once you've got that gift in your hands, it ought to make you a different kind of person. And that's what we're saying with Hope Forward. What if we could apply that model, mm-hmm. that ethic, to the way we fund an education? So what if we just give it away up front? You receive a gift of education that was funded by somebody else, mm-hmm. and then that ought to make you a different kind of person, the receipt of that gift. And so the whole idea is we've got some students, there's about 85 students or so who are helping us pilot this. Our ambition is one day to have the whole college on this mm-hmm. model. These students sign a covenant. And as part of that covenantal agreement, they commit to giving something to Hope every year for the rest of their lives after they graduate. And what they're doing when they're giving to Hope after graduation is they're investing in the generations of students mm-hmm. who come after them. So theirs was paid for, and now as they graduate, they're giving mm-hmm. Because they received that gift up front. And so it's basically... it's taking a business model that today is based on bill paying and debt, because mm-hmm. the vast majority of our students fund their education in part through student debt. So it's taking a model based on bill paying and debt and transitioning it to a model that's based on generosity at its core, which we think is transformational for the business model, obviously. I think it's also transformational in terms of the kind of relationship we can have with students. We talk with students all the time about the difference between a transactional relationship and mm-hmm. a covenantal relationship. So I think it's character forming mm-hmm. in some really exciting ways. Not just a business model change, but I think it's a pretty, really interesting cultural change mm-hmm. that is actually, I think, a better reflection of the gospel.
Yeah, I think of 2 Corinthians 8, where Paul's trying to motivate the Corinthian church to give and towards generosity. Right. And he specifically calls them back to reflect on the sacrifice of Christ. And it's like he could say, listen, come on, guys. You're the Corinthian church. You have resources. This is an opportunity to make a difference, these mm-hmm. kinds of appeals. Mm-hmm. And instead, he appeals to, this is what you've experienced through Christ. This is how you've experienced grace.
Yeah, right.
And he's trying to motivate them out of that place to give and to be generous for others. And I feel like, you know, in a similar way, that's what you're talking about. Now, if I am... in a leadership position where that's what I'm hoping for, I am really going to sit down with these students and make sure they understand biblical principles with a whole different level of intentionality.
Right. Right.
Did the students who are part of Hope Forward, would they go through a different kind of experience besides the actual mm-hmm. document that they sign and go, I get it. But do they get built into in unique ways for that reason?
They do. We have some specific programming for those cohorts. So they get together a couple of times a month on mm-hmm. average. And there's, you know, sometimes it's a guest speaker, sometimes it's a volunteer activity. So there's a kind of a myriad of different ways. But yeah, we're very intentional about talking to them about, you know, we kind of break it down into three pillars: access, community, and generosity.
Okay.
The access piece is, you know, what I think as Christians, the fundamental belief is that God equally distributed talent, but the broken world has not distributed opportunity in an equal mm-hmm. way. And so what would happen if there was truly equal opportunity, if there was access to equal opportunity, what would that look like? Yeah. And that's in part what Hope Forward is. That's the puzzle we're trying to solve. Community is this whole idea of moving from a transactional relationship to a covenantal relationship. And then generosity is what you're... I mean, it's crazy, man. If you read the Bible and you're looking for it, God says over and over and over again that he will bless giving.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in the Old Testament, the New Testament,
totally.
The prophets, the Paul's letters. It's all over the place. And what's crazy is God never says he'll bless us for paying our bills. It's just not there. He says he'll bless us for giving, but we don't get blessed for paying our bills. So like, if nothing else, we're excited about what this will mean for our students mm-hmm. because they by definition have signed up to be givers who will be receivers then of this blessing that God gives.
Well, and I love the idea that you've talked about this before, but we have a lot of students who are maybe God's placed in them a unique vision or dream for the future, but then by virtue of their debt load following college or, sure, or graduate school or whatever, they say, it would be nice, but my daughter's going to have to, I think, navigate this. She's right now on a pre-med track,
right,
and she's going to presumably walk out of med school with considerable debt. And
right,
she's got a heart for serving internationally and
right,
in a very in need kind of context.
That's right. Yeah.
So how are we going to make that happen? You
right
know, and I know God will open up a way, but when you've had, is it two classes of students?
We're on our third now.
On our third. Okay. Yeah. So they haven't had a chance yet kind of start the process.
That's right.
Post-education.
Yeah.
That'll be really fun to see that play out. And I'm sure
cool
you guys will be on the edge of your seats.
Yeah.
Okay,
right,
here we go.
Yeah, right.
One of the things that when our podcast, kind of the big ideas made to advance that we're called to move forward. And one of the things I really like to talk about is you can't move forward, particularly in bold or fresh kinds of ways, without experiencing opposition. There's always going to be, if you launch, I mean, what you are trying to do with Hope Forward, it's a huge vision. It's not been done before.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you talk about, you still in certain, you know, you'll be in certain contexts and you feel like this, you know, I don't know if you'd use the word embarrassed. I'm putting that in your mouth a little bit, but that feeling of where everybody around you is like, are you serious right now?
Yeah, right.
I mean, are we talking
that's
about
right
the same
yeah
thing?
That's right.
So that's just, and the thing is, I heard you talk about that. I thought that's the reality. How many times, without even commenting directly on Hope Forward,
right,
how many times in the Bible would have people said the same thing about people that God is calling to do a big thing? So I guess I would love for you to share what so far has encouraged you about the Hope Forward journey, but also to the extent you feel comfortable, what have been the challenges in leading an initiative that literally doesn't have a comparison?
Yeah, thanks. I think one of the there's been amazing things that have happened that I would say are just unexplainable unless you look at it through the lens of the Holy Spirit's blowing us in this direction.
Mm.
And the more recent one I would point to is, you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell. And Malcolm Gladwell, you know, obviously has absolutely no connection to Hope. He heard about what we're trying to do. He invited himself to our campus, spent 2 days on our campus recording content for a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And then featured us in a very positive way on his Revisionist History podcast. And there's a cultural icon who's very well respected by
right
almost everybody in the country, perhaps the world right now. And I don't know how to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to explain that happening unless you look at it through the lens of, I think God is in this. I think God is, I think this is a divinely inspired thing that's
mm-hmm
in part showing the world that the Christian gospel can help solve societal problems. And maybe it's the case that when we're really wrestling with something, maybe the first place we ought to go is, I wonder what Jesus has to say
mm-hmm
about this. I wonder what the Bible has to say about how we could solve this problem. And that's exactly what we did. And one of the things that Malcolm said when he came to campus is he said, I love this because you've depoliticized Jesus. Like, this is an unpoliticizable idea. You're just taking what Jesus talks about and going after a societal
mm-hmm
problem. And I think it's, yeah, I think it's beautiful. And there's that we could talk all day. There's been so many both big and small
yeah
ways in which I've seen God's presence show up through unexplainable just forces of momentum
yeah
behind the idea. On the flip side of that is there's often the case where I sort of feel like kind of crazy. I mean,
mm-hmm,
I don't mean to overinflate this in any way, but some days I feel like this must have been how Noah felt when he's like building a boat for years and years on end when it's not even raining.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you doing,
right,
dude? Like, and he's like, oh, God told me to build this boat because there's a storm coming. And some days I feel like that. And I feel like that in part because Hope's in a really strong position right
mm-hmm
now. And so, you know, obviously it's easier to innovate from a position of strength, but there's also sometimes the question of like, why are we changing this? Like, we've got really strong enrollment.
Right.
We've got really strong momentum with the old business model. So why are we so focused on changing it? And I mean, it's a fair question. I think going back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, there's enormous pressure on the current business model. So just because it's working now and just because it's worked in the past doesn't mean it's going to work in perpetuity. And anyway, so yeah, there's
I hadn't thought that's a great point. You know, typically the best time to propose a new idea, a new approach, whatever, is when you've got a clear pinch point, a problem, or whatever. I mean, that really does pave the way. I had not thought about the fact that hope is...
It's a forcing mechanism.
Yes, hope's doing well, and I haven't thought about how that actually... I mean, in many cases, comfort works against innovation. I mean, that's just the way it is. So it takes a different kind of leadership to push new radical things. And yet, and to your point a minute ago, is just because the broader forces, macro level forces, are not affecting hope in the same way they may be have some other institutions. You know, to be forward thinking, I mean, this includes the church. I mean, we want to be in places where it's not just pain that's driving us to make changes. You know, you want to get ahead of the curve. So hopefully, if you're making changes only in reaction to negative forces, typically you're already behind. So anyway, so cool. You guys are. So now I'm curious. So you talked about, you know, you feel like sometimes you're in the Noah chair as far as that's concerned. When people bring up, if you were to say the top one or two questions or objections, or I'm giving you a chance to say, I hear you, but you know, like what do people say? Yeah, but like, for example, if I was guessing, I thought, what would people say? If I'm, of course, on the surface, a lot of people would probably say, oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
But I bet somebody said, yeah, but isn't it good for people to have skin in the game? Have you heard that before?
Of course, I definitely have.
Is that top three?
That's number one, for sure.
Okay.
I mean, the number one and number two are, this feels like free tuition. And usually the way it's framed is people won't appreciate something if it's free. So that's a version of the sort of skin in the game argument that you just described. The second one is some flavor of, this seems like a great idea, but I just don't think it's possible. I don't think you can raise enough money to do this. Even when it's in motion, I'm less convinced people will uphold their end of the covenant. So it doesn't feel possible. So it's usually those are the two I get. I don't like it because it's free, or two, maybe I like it, but I'm just not convinced it's actually going to work, or that you can pull this off.
Respond to those?
Okay, well, thank you for asking, Brian. I think on the free one, it's actually not free because it's a covenant. First of all, college is never going to be free. It's a very expensive endeavor, especially the kind of college that we do at Hope. It's a very high touch model. So by definition, that means it's very expensive.
Right.
I think the question we ought to ask is who should pay for it and when? And part of what we're saying is, shouldn't or what if students could pay during their earnings years rather than pay upfront? And the other thing is, you know, right now with tuition rates so high, students aren't paying their own tuition. It's somebody else paying for it. Your parents, your grandparents, somebody else is for the most part paying students' tuition. And so in part what we're doing with this model is giving students the dignity of being able to pay for their education again. They're simply paying for it through gifts when they're in their earnings years rather than, upfront.
Right.
So I think that's the bottom line, is that it's not free. Students are personally invested. They've committed to give their own hard-earned money after they graduate. And by the way, we're seeing that manifest itself in the with obviously it's early days and the data's limited, but we're seeing learnings results from the students who are part of these pilot cohorts. That's really encouraging. So we're seeing,
as far as their academic performance,
retention and GPA and things like that. Yeah. We're seeing that these students actually are taking their education more seriously, not less.
Yeah.
So I think in some ways, you know, it's one thing for me to have arguments against the criticism, but I think the data will actually be the best way to rebut it.
That's really cool. It's cool to see those results because they're good, apart from having the financial side of things, which can't kick in yet because you're on the front end of the whole thing. It's cool to see those examples, though, of them taking it seriously. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day relative to the whole model. When we might think, well, do you have skin in the game? I get that, do you have financial skin in the game? But to have a successful career in college and walk out with a diploma, you had to have some skin in the game with other kinds of investment, with work time and all kinds of things.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not like once the bill's paid, I just sit around on the sofa and I walk out with a degree. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. I think the other obstacles you mentioned is just the practical one.
Is it possible? Can we pull this off?
And that's where you're saying it's going to take a move of God.
Yes.
I don't have the 10-step plan that, you
that's
know.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the best response to that is, I believe in a God who says with me, all things are possible.
Yeah.
So is it possible? Anything's possible. Anything is possible. And that's what hope, the ideal, the virtue is mm-hmm. all about. I mean, I think because we're called hope, that means the people who walk through our doors believe that questions have answers and problems mm-hmm. are solvable and anything is possible because of the God we serve.
You mentioned in your address at the beginning of the school year
yeah.
that when it comes to financial kind of fundraising goals and whatnot, that was the one particular goal that's more of a stretch goal.
Yeah, right.
And so on the one hand, and this is one of these tensions that we balance as leaders, on the one hand, you'd be the first one to say it's going to take a move of the Holy Spirit for this mm-hmm. to happen. There's mm-hmm. no genius president out there who's going to take a school of hope size and all of a sudden show up with $1 billion. I mean,
right.
it's going to take something special from God. That being said, you have some degree of plans when it comes to saying, hey, we need to have some escalating goals when it comes to what we're shooting for with fundraising and whatnot. How's your team kind of balancing that, our part, the plan, et cetera, versus what do we need to just trust God for? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we're doing lots of planning and lots of lots of strategy and lots of scenario planning and lots of we've got great fundraisers, world-class yeah. fundraisers. So it's not that we're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question is, are we going to let God lead the institution or are we going to try to do it entirely through our own strength?
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're saying is, we've got our sails up and we're going to let the Holy Spirit blow us.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, going back to the Proverbs verse, in his heart, a man plans his course, but God determines his steps. It doesn't say it's bad to plan. But at the end of the day, God has something determined for
yeah.
you. And the question is, are you going to see what God has for you or are you going to miss it? And so, yeah, we've got lots of plans. We've got lots of goals. But at the end of the day, the big thing we're trying to do is follow the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And the Holy Spirit's going to light this up when he decides it's time to light this up. And we're just, I think part of my challenge as a leader, this is going to take a long time, regardless, I think. I mean, it's possible that, some big check comes in tomorrow and it's done in a day. Probably not.
And if you're out there, the mailing
right.
address
and
is.
And the reason we're... and that brings me to... Yeah, I mean, the challenge as a leader is... keeping a community excited
mm-hmm.
about an idea that's going to, this is a marathon, not a sprint, and keeping a community excited and patient at the same time. And I would say keeping myself patient at the same time, because I can be impatient. And I believe so firmly that this is from God, which means it's going to happen. It's simply a question of when. And yeah, my impatience gets the best of me some days. Some people ask too, because I talk so openly about this idea as being an idea that's from God, being an idea that's divinely inspired. And some people say, why do you talk about it that way? Why don't you just say, like, this is an idea we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe you believe it's from God, but why do you have to talk about it so publicly as
yeah.
an idea from God? And I think the reason I feel the need to do that is because when it happens, I want God to get the credit for it.
Mm.
I don't want anybody to say, look at Matt, look at what he pulled off or what his team pulled off or what Hope pulled off. No, I want everybody to say,
yeah.
look at what the Lord did. Look at what the Lord did
at this
in this community.
Where do you think their resistance to, are they worried that you're baptizing an idea with overly spiritual language and therefore it gives it a, where's the concern rooted in of why do you talk about it in that fashion, mentioning God?
Oh, I think it could be a number of reasons. I think it could be that. I think it could be what would that turn off some people?
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe there's some people who, would say this is a great idea, but I don't understand why Jesus is attached to it. Like,
yeah.
can't this just be about innovation? Why does it have to be, why do you have to talk about it in such spiritual terms?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think it could, that pushback could take a different,
sure.
A bunch of different flavors to it.
For anybody who's trying to do anything big, and especially if it's going to take, by definition, if it's a significant thing, it's probably going to take some time. How do you, and you spoke to this already, and this is one of the things I really wanted to ask you. I think a lot of us deal with how do you keep yourself motivated, mm-hmm. excited, positive when you're getting opposition, those kinds of things. Now, I know you're a naturally optimistic person, so I thought maybe he's just going to say, I just wake up every day and I get so excited to raise $1 billion and never struggle with losing hope or energy or whatever. But maybe there's, you know, every 16th Wednesday, maybe you have 15 minutes where you're just a little, you know, like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How do you motivate yourself? How do you keep hope alive within you on the days where it doesn't come as naturally?
This is going to sound cheesy. I can't motivate myself and I don't even try anymore. I've just given up. I just ask the Lord to do it for me. So on the days when I'm bummed out, the days when I'm discouraged, the days when I feel like, why is this taking so long? I'll just ask God point blank, give me some encouragement. And nine times out of ten, he's so gracious. And all of a sudden, some little piece of good news will come in, or some email or an unexpected check or something will come in. And it's just like, okay, that's what I needed to get me through today. It's enough. It's enough to get me through today. And tomorrow God will give me something else. And it's like these little breadcrumbs. It's like God is just, he's so gracious and so near and so faithful. That he won't let me run away from this. And I feel like if I tried to, it'd be like Jonah. He'd send a whale to swallow me and spit me back out here. So like, I'm just, you know, I don't even try to pump myself up anymore. Cause I think the hope I get from God is way better than anything I could do, anything I could do to fire myself up.
Yeah. I've had so many moments like that where I'm sitting at my desk and for whatever reason, don't have my normal level of energy or passion. And I just say, Lord, I just need something today. It doesn't have to be, doesn't have to be a huge thing, but I need something. And it's so cool. I mean, right now my mind's flashing with different times where I've been working on a message. And for whatever reason, I just feel downcast and I say, Lord, I need something. And then I finish the message. I go to check my email and there is this email from someone who says, God has used Engedi in my life in such profound ways, and they describe it. And I'm sitting there, thank you, Lord, you know, tears and just like, thank you, Lord, you're doing it, you know, and it's those moments are so rich. And I don't need to ask for those a lot. I would say that I need, but there are, you know, a few times a year where I'm saying, Lord, I think for me, another thing though, I've found helps keep me passionate, so to speak, is sometimes you're doing the mechanics of living out your responsibilities.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just got to keep coming back to the why.
Yeah.
Because sending out emails or I don't know else, it doesn't always feel like, wow, this is some big stuff right now.
Yeah.
But just remembering what the little things are all about in the bigger picture, that keeps me
excited.
You
have more faith than I do. I have to ask all the time for encouragement from God. But I think, here's what I've learned about God. I think God, if God were a sports fan, he likes a close game and he likes a come from behind winner. And I think, you know, in my observation, I'm not a huge sports person, but I think there's kind of two kinds of sports fans. There's one kind of fan where you love your team so much that you never get comfortable unless your team is like way ahead, unless it's just a blowout game, then you can finally relax. And there's another kind of sports fan where you actually kind of like it when your team falls behind, because then they can be a comeback victor. And God is totally that kind of sports fan.
Yeah.
He loves pulling victory out of the jaws of defeat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just his go-to move over and over again. He gives somebody an idea. The idea looks like it's going great. All of a sudden, there's all this opposition. Looks like it's going to fail. And then all of a sudden, I mean, it's the story of Jesus. Yeah. Like, Jesus is going to save the world. Looks like it's going great. Big miracles. Everybody's getting fed. Everybody's getting healed. All of a sudden, Jesus is killed. Well, what's going to happen? Then he comes back.
Right.
Then he comes back. It's like just when it looks like it's totally going to, like, totally game over, that's when he likes to act. And I think once you realize that's the story that God likes to tell over and over again. And once you realize that we just get to be actors in the play that God has written, then you can like almost sit back and say, wow, it's going to be fun to see how God uses this twist in the journey to be part of how we get there.
Yeah, that's a great word. And you're compelled when you get to that place and you see God do it however he does it.
Yeah.
You're compelled back to the point that you said earlier about why you talk about hope forward in such God-centered terms,
yeah.
you're compelled to say, look what God did. It's not it's not like, oh, look what Matt did and you know, all this. Look what the team did. It's look what God did. He let us be a little part, but it was his work. Anything else you want to share before we end today?
It's been an honor to have you on, to have me on. Thank you for, for this invitation. No, I think we talked about all the things.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you could join us and I've been looking forward to this conversation.
I appreciate your
faith. I appreciate you leading with courage and we are in an interesting time of history when it comes to, and you already alluded to this, when it comes to matters of faith, when it comes to matters of higher education. I'm just wired that when opposition hits or when some kind of tension with doing what we're called to do hits, there is a part of me that's motivated because I just go, all right, this is a time to trust God and to seek him in prayer like never before. And so from that standpoint, I get excited for some of the headwinds we're in because it gives you a chance and hope to step out in faith in new ways. And when it comes, same for the church. I'm like, all right, this is a great time for us to step up in all new ways.
Yeah. I did this thing in DC a few weeks ago for this organization called Center for Christianity and Public Leadership. And they referenced a poll that was done, I think the first time was done 20 years ago, and then they redid it recently. And that basically the question was, is religion in the United States part of the problem or part of the solution? Like, is religion good or bad? Basically, that wasn't the wording they used, but that's basically the essence of the question.
Yeah.
And 20 years ago, it was basically 80-20. Like, 80% of people felt like religion in the U.S. was a force for good. Today, it's 50-50. So 50% of people think that religion in the U.S. is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And I think what the role Christians can play in that is to say, like, let's apply the Christian gospel to real problems and show the world that this isn't politics. This is a God who promises to make all things new, a God who is not just in the business of redeeming human souls. He's doing that, but he's also redeeming creation, and we get to be a part of that. God doesn't act alone. He uses human partners to do stuff, and we get to be part of that. And I do think, I agree with you 100%, the despair that exists in our world and in our church is an opportunity for true followers of Jesus to say, look at the hope we have and look what this hope can do.
What a great note to end on. Matt, thank you for being with us today. And I'm going to hope and pray that as we've had this conversation and kind of an echo of 2019 when you first joined us here at Engedi, I'm going to hope and pray that this message goes far and wide and continues to
thank you for having
aid
me on.
And it's support great. All of the good work you're doing at Hope. Thanks for being on the
Thanks,
show.
Brian.
I'm so thankful we could have that conversation with Matt. I hear him talk about just having a big God-given dream and pursuing it. And honestly, it challenges and inspires my faith. What does it mean to trust God for the big things and then to walk faithfully in that direction over a long period of time? That's the difficult part of sometimes. We have the big dream, we're excited about it, but then when it doesn't happen tomorrow or in a couple months or even in a couple years, all of a sudden we're like, maybe, maybe not. And the reality is most of us are called to things that are bigger than a couple of years. So I'm encouraged by his example of faith, and I hope you were too. In fact, if this content, if this conversation was helpful to you, I want to encourage you to comment, to follow us, and to maybe share this podcast with your friends. We'd love to get the word out. This has been an Engedi Church production, and we are committed to bringing more conversations just like this your way. So until next time, just know that you were made to advance.